Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today bought his first Civil War book while on vacation in the South in the summer he turned 12. Rick Barham was born in Chico and grew up in Oakland. At Chico State University Sacramento, he majored in government, was on the school newspaper staff, and was active in theater. He married a girl from Chester and moved to Red Bluff to pursue a teaching credential at Chico State. He teaches social studies and theater arts and has directed many plays at Central Valley High School. Rick Barham has had a lifelong interest in history and especially military history, and in 1995 became involved in Civil War reenacting, which combines his interest in theater and history. He has made four trips back east to visit Civil War sites and attended two large national events, the 135th and the 150th anniversaries of the Battle at Gettysburg. He has now written a book about how the men in a volunteer infantry fought and died, the 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War. Rick Barham, welcome.
Thank you.
This is actually not your first attempt at a book.
It is not.
What did you start writing before this?
Years ago, I was very interested in dinosaurs and paleontology, and I was determined I was going to write a book that was going to shed all the new research about dinosaur life and times and make that for teachers. And ended up doing a technical review for somebody else's book, but my book didn't get published.
Well, this book is it looks like a tremendous amount of research. How long did you work on this book?
This is a culmination of many years of creating articles for our club newsletter. I'm a Civil War reenactor. But really about 6 years of dedicated, actually, we're making a book now, and let's put it all together.
Mm-hmm. So the title of your book is The 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War, A History and Roster. Now, how did you choose the New York Infantry, this 72nd?
Again, that harkens back to my Civil War reenacting. We actually did a little research project and came upon this unit as one that was a pretty fighting regiment. We wanted to be a New York regiment, and a couple of circumstances came together, and we chose the 72nd. There wasn't a lot of published information on that when we started, but the more we dug, got to it, and eventually we have a book.
So you chose them because they were on scene at the major events in the Civil War.
Exactly. They were a three-year regiment. They started very early on. They were in all the major battles. In fact, the only one that they missed was Antietam. They were Chancellorsville, Gettysburg. There were three battles where at least a fourth of the regiment was casualties.
Well, now, you just mentioned they were three-year volunteers. So people might not remember their history to remember that. Well, they probably remember that when it started, both sides said, oh, this is going to be a short war. And so Lincoln only said, well, we only need 90 days. So we'll sign people up for 90 days. And then this group, though, was signed up for 3 years.
Exactly.
So that's what you meant by three-year volunteers.
Right. This is one of the
a three-year commitment.
Earlier batches, right, exactly. He signed them up for 90 days. Once Bull Run happened, realized, my goodness, this is going to go much longer. By that time, they were already converting to three-year volunteer enlistments. And so this was among some of the first batch of three-year volunteers.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of fervor, and people are very excited. People want to volunteer. So what was it like? You have in your book the Dunkirk paper. Is describing the departure of these two companies from the local depot. So what was that scene like?
Well, again, this was something, these were people that had their family, their homes in Dunkirk is in western New York in Chautauqua County. These were people that everybody knew. These were the cream of society, shall we say. And so the ladies had, brought out the cakes, and they had the uniforms and everything. There was the band, and the fire department escorted them to the railroad station and everything, and there was much hoopla, and of course the mayor and all the city fathers gave them wonderful, wonderful send-offs.
So they're off to a good start, and you said the next day there was a German company, and I don't know if people realize that at that time that was the largest ethnic minority in the United States. Germans.
Right. Everybody kind of thinks about Irish being in the war and everything. But actually, you're right. Germans were the largest ethnic minority in the United States. And in this particular regiment, which is a little bit unique in the history of regiments, in that it was drawn from across New York State. There's even one company from New Jersey in it. Half the regiment came from out west, Chautauqua County. The other part came from New York City, and that's where one of the German companies came out of New York City.
My guest is Rick Barham, and he has written a history of the 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War. Well, you have the actual words of these participants in the 72nd Infantry, and I enjoyed all of them. I'd like you to read, if you would, on page 13, there's a farmer named Charles Gould, and he writes to his sister, and he described what the accommodations were like, because that's what I would like to know. I think those of us now want to know. We know about the big battles, but what we want to know is, what was it like to be with this group, and what were their meals like? So would you read that? See that there at the top of the page?
Mm-hmm. Accommodations here are not so good as they expected, but I have a little easier. Shortly after I came here, I became servant for the First Lieutenant John P. Sanford. I have just been out on parade. It is very hot and the excitement is very intense. The captain, Robert T. Johnson, has just left his tent in my hands and has gone to the seashore to bathe. For breakfast, we have three large crackers and some beef. For dinner, it is bread with soup or coffee or soup. For supper, we have the same again. There are about 600 tents made up of white canvas and properly arranged, presenting a handsome appearance.
And these are the words of Charles Gould, who is a farmer, and he's writing his sister. Now, there was something else that, so he's talking about the tents, and but he was quite happy with that, so to speak, but he was not happy when it got to be Sunday.
Correct.
What was the problem with Sundays?
There was quite some very deep-held religious commitments on a lot of these men. And they were used to Sunday being, of course, the Lord's Day and resting and worshiping and that sort of thing. So when they came to the army, and war does not recognize the Sabbath, and this was a big shock to them, and this was all in the letters going back home. Shall I read?
Yeah, read that.
It is Sunday, but Sunday is not regarded here. The drums are beating all day and firing off muskets with reports of pistols continually elate the ear. The men here are of the roughest kind. Gambling, fighting, and swearing seem to be the principal amusement, little thinking that the vast number will never see home again. There are two rows of guards. Men attempting to go by them occasionally get stabbed.
I think I would be shocked at that. But when you consider where they drew, I mean, they wanted recruits, they wanted volunteers, so they would take pretty much anybody, regardless of their morals.
Right. And so where this is happening, they were assembled on Staten Island early on. So they were still in the process of forming up the regiment, forming up the whole brigade, which is five regiments, you know, combined. And so this was coming to a big shock, particularly from the boys out west, who were farmers and fishermen on Lake Erie. And again, the family unit was very important, and the community unit was very important. The other part of the regiment that was formed, these were just people from New York City primarily, and a lot of them were gutter sweeps. A lot of them traded prison sentences to go into the army. So when the recruiter came to the judge and said, "Do you have anybody who would trade coming to the army with us versus going to jail?" And those guys said, "Sure, we'll take the army instead of."
So here's innocent farmer Charles Gould right next to a convict.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And he is displeased with the disrespect for the Sabbath.
Yes.
Well, the founders of this group, you need money for tents, you need money for food, supplies, horses. So where did this money come from?
Well, there was the man who formed the whole brigade was a man by the name of Dan Sickles, who went on to be famous in the Battle of Gettysburg. And they were given a amount of money by the state to begin to form a brigade, a regiment. Well, what happened was he was probably more successful than they anticipated. And being a Democrat, where you had a Republican governor, there was a lot of political infighting there. And at one point, he was ordered by the governor to disband his regiment and just take it back down to disband his brigade, which was five regiments, send all but one regiment worth back home. Dan Sickle said, "This sounds like dirty politics to me, so I'll go directly to Lincoln." And at one point, his brigade was enlisted as United States volunteers instead of New York volunteers. And so so Dan Sickles got his brigade.
But to do that, there was a huge debt. You mentioned that in your book, a 2 months bill of nearly $400,000. And I was wondering, is that $400,000 in money at that time?
Yes.
That's astounding. And I could understand why the creditors wanted to get paid before Sickles left for the war.
Right, exactly. So they were running up these huge bills. The popular idea was that, oh, Dan Sickles just paid for this out of his pocket. In fact, he perpetuated that myth. Well, that wasn't the case. He was just running up all these debts. And the gentleman who formed the brigade with him, who was basically his main quartermaster, was just kind of left in the lurch as Dan Sickle, at one point this man writes, Dan Sickle marched his brigade off and then leaving me with all these judgments against him. And I denounced him then and I denounce him now.
Leaving me with holding the bag, so
yes,
to speak.
Right.
My guest is Rick Barham, and his book is about the 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War. And you describe the soldiers' gear. And I was interested in the difference in, could you say they had haversacks and backpacks? And I was wondering, well, what's the difference in a haversack and a backpack?
Well, a haversack is like a, shall we say, a manly purse that you would wear over your shoulder, and it would be slung down on your left hip. And this would be smaller items, a few food stuff, some ammunition, maybe letters home, a picture, that sort of thing, very personal items. And this you would carry with you all the time. The backpack, that was your...
It had two straps, and the haversack had one strap.
Exactly. The backpack you put on your back. This had the blanket, the part of the tent that you would carry all the... So when you were actually moving from place to place and you weren't intending to come back, you put everything in the backpack and went forward. So,
you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Rick Barham, a Civil War reenactor. Listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Well, you say that every tool, axe, shovel, and cooking pot was marked with a regimental number in the company letter. Tents were labeled on their outsides, indicating the regiment and company, so when they folded, they could be easily identified. Personal gear such as cartridge boxes, and you mentioned the haversacks and backpacks, were stenciled with each soldier's name, number, and company letter. Officers, who always tended toward having a few extra luxuries, would reduce gear to the minimum. Company officers were to ensure each man had proper gear in anticipation of a move. Tin cups, plates, knives, forks, and spoons were issued to those who somehow didn't have them or had lost them. And at this point, it's the middle of summer. Rain was frequent, so they had heavy overcoats called greatcoats, were issued along with woolen and rubber blankets that doubled as ground cloths and rainproof ponchos. So this is what the enlisted man carried.
Correct.
Officers had a little different deal. Mm-hmm. Also, and I hadn't thought of this before, but when the going got rough, the enlisted men could not desert. I mean, they did, but they weren't supposed to. Whereas an officer said, oh, it's getting rough now. I think I'll just resign and go home.
Exactly.
I never thought about that, but that seems terribly unfair.
It was very unfair. So just like in the, you know, there's some extent to that in the modern military, but back then, you're right. You enlisted for 3 years. You had this commitment as an enlisted man. When you had your commission, you were, you know, you could resign that and go home. So after each battle, major battle, you would see not only were, of course, men wounded and killed, the officers, but then you had a series of these resignations. And so then after every battle, there was this great shuffling of now you had to take your senior sergeants, make them lieutenants. You had to take your lieutenants, make them captains, and, you know, so on and so forth. So there's this great shuffling. This took place over the course of the year. So by the time we get to the last year of their commitment, the last 6 months of their commitment, there were very few men in the officer corps who were there at the beginning. They were all enlisted or had joined since then.
Well, the so Dan Sickles fills his regiment, and finally off they go. And there was a sentence by a chaplain in your book that women favored us with clouds of fluttering handkerchiefs at every station. And I can just see those women waving their handkerchiefs to these soldiers who are going off to war. But their reception was not the same as they went along. For example, when they got to Baltimore, Maryland, their reception there was not like the send-off that they had experienced before.
Not at all. So you have to envision where they're coming from. They're leaving Staten Island. They come through Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, the town rolls out the red carpet. They have these
fluttering handkerchiefs.
Fluttering handkerchiefs. They have these establishments that are paid for by the citizenry. They take the men in. They can wash. They can eat. Wonderful. That sort of thing. They get back on the train. And by then, when they arrive in Baltimore, Baltimore is very much a question whether it's, you know, there's a
whose
lot.
Whose side are they on?
Exactly, exactly. And Maryland as a whole state's barely hanging on to the Union. So when they come in, you know, nobody is smiling, nobody's waving. You know, this is a state that only a few months before, when Massachusetts volunteers came through there on the train, there was a huge riot and people were killed. And so This is a very different experience.
In fact, this whole area, when they get there, you're never quite sure, are they secessionist? Maybe they really have strong feelings against the Union. Mm-hmm. And so that made for a really difficult situation for the Union soldiers.
Right, especially when they were in all of these places, because, you know, the war is being fought in Virginia, the war is being fought in Maryland. There's only a couple of opportunities in the whole war where they know that they're fighting on very loyal ground. You know, when they go up to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and then Antietam, that was in a part of Maryland that was pretty strong Union.
Well, there are several quotes about the gambling and profanity on the part of the soldiers. And Charles Gould says they were lying around drunk. When you came to these kinds of quotes, what did you what did you think of that?
Well, I thought it was wonderful. Oh wow, this is great stuff. This just, you know, gave a lot of texture to the regiment, to the story. You have to remember, you had this great contrast of styles. You had these Western men, very religious, very proper, loved by their families. Then you have these New York men that, you know, would desert if they could, kind of a thing, and very rough sort. And there's even a part of a letter in there, I don't think it's from Charles Gould, where they talk about how, you know, we kind of kept our distance from those New York City boys because we weren't quite sure. But now the regiment's coming together and anybody can mingle with anybody from either any station.
Well, because if you're writing a history of your side, your guys are heroes. Mm-hmm. And they're not lying around drunk. So that part is not in the history books. That's why we have to rely on people like Charles Gould to tell us what it was really like.
Yes.
That's what these guys are doing. So Dan Sickles, you mentioned he makes some enemies, like the guy he left in debt.
Mm-hmm.
But he is quite popular with the president and Mrs. Lincoln.
Yes. Yes. He, because he's the man who can get things done. And President Lincoln was definitely looking for people who could make this happen. So anybody who showed energy like Dan Sickles, and particularly being a Democrat, okay, he was in Congress.
Before he did this, before mm-hmm. his military career, Dan Sickles was in Congress.
Right. And as a Democrat, you needed any war Democrat that you could have in your ranks who, you know, you could rely on.
Well, so he's Dan Sickles is very popular there, unlike with the guy that he left in the lurch. And then there's kind of some horseplay that goes on in the camps. For example, we're imagining all these guys are heroes and they're very wise. They wouldn't play with a shell that could explode.
Right. This is much later on. They can move to Maryland, Southern Maryland, and they are part of an occupying force. Southern Maryland was very treasonous, very secessionist. And so you had men coming down from Baltimore through Southern Maryland, making their way across the Potomac to Virginia to join the Confederate Army. So Sickles and this regiment were put there to try to intercept that. Well, there was cannons on the Virginia side of the Potomac, and they would shoot at ships coming up the Potomac. Well, these balls would miss and come over on their side. So I can very well see this bored 18-year-old. They had found this shell. Somebody had poured out the powder out of it. It was unexploded. Then he gets it, and somehow it comes to the campfire, and they're playing with it. They think it's an amusement, and somehow, somebody gets the bright idea of sticking a burning ember, we don't know if it's a cigar or what, in the fuse hole. I don't know what they expected it to have happen, but this thing exploded. This guy was killed almost instantly. You can just imagine pieces of this cannonball going, you know, ripping through camp, and all the guys who were just laughing in hysterical moment before just like tumbling back with chunks of this iron going into them is something else.
Well, that was not a very wise thing to be entertaining yourself with. But they did have some pastimes that rather surprised me. Well, some of them didn't. You mentioned they played dominoes, chess, checkers, cards. That part I thought, yeah, they're sitting around mm-hmm. playing cards, I expect that. But what surprised me was debate. They organized debates.
Again, this was these Western boys from a little bit more sophisticated, and they had this little debate society. And I like the description in it, because they would take on these very strong topics, but then they would say,
You
didn't get to choose what side of the issue you were on. And they avoided some issues that, you know, would have, you know, really, you know, stir the emotions and that sort of thing. But
Said, in fact, sometimes since somebody would just arbitrarily assign one side of the issue, that they would actually convince themselves, well, maybe I should rethink this.
Exactly. And that's a wonderful description there. I think this is by Arthur McKinstry, who was the nephew of a newspaper man back in Chautauqua County. And so for the first few months of the war, he was sending back these letters that would then get published. Unfortunately, he was killed on May 5th of 62 at the Battle of Williamsburg, and this wonderful supply of these letters and his descriptions of the camp go away.
My guest is Rick Barham, and he has written a history of the 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War. So So they have these pastimes when they have leisure time, so to speak. But then when things get serious, they realize they need a hospital. And so how do you go about creating a hospital out in the woods?
Well, again, when they're creating the hospital, this is pretty much they are in Maryland. They realize that people are dying from, kind of ridiculous things.
Not from battle necessarily.
Not from battle necessarily, right. And so they, take it upon themselves to build a hospital, what they call a hospital. It's very small. And in fact, somebody writes, you can understand how we don't get well with some of us crammed into this small space. But that was a big problem for both armies throughout the war, what to do with the huge number of casualties. How do you deal with them? They really hadn't even thought this through in any way, shape, or form. When they move on to what's called the Peninsula Campaign, starting about April, May of 62, and going through all the spring, when the sick and wounded are finally being able to be evacuated and sent out, the men of the regiment, how they're so relieved because now they don't have to worry about these guys. They can move, they can march, they can fight, and they don't have to worry about these number of guys that they're having to take care of all the time.
Well, they built a log hospital. Mm-hmm. One thing, too, that back when the wintertime comes, they think, they just were pretty much stuck without going off to war, and so they built log accommodations for themselves.
Precisely. They built these, what were just commonly referred to as winter quarters. With the rain and the snow and everything coming in the winter, you couldn't move the artillery, you couldn't move the wagons, you couldn't march. So everybody just kind of settled down and waited for spring to come, and then you'd start fighting again. And there's a couple of men in here who apparently were very good at building these little cabins. And their design services were sought out by other commands. And so they would go and show, how to make a stove that would draw properly. You wouldn't want a stove or a chimney in your little shebang or whatever you want, cabin, that would, smoke and everything. So they would take they would build it up, and oftentimes they'd have the tents they were issued, and they'd put that on top, but they would be able to stand up, and six or eight men could sleep in one of these things. They're very comfortable.
So they had the tent over the top. You mentioned, too, that there was new technology. You mentioned in your book this new technology for reconnaissance. And you quote, this guy named Thaddeus Lowe, mm-hmm. who was a Yankee aeronaut, who had this balloon for reconnaissance. And even his name, Thaddeus, that is so 19th century. Don't run into many people named Thaddeus these days. But he arrived at Hooker's camp. And guess who was one of the first people to go up in this little three-man basket?
Dan Sickles. Right, yes. So you can imagine, this is how I kind of envision this. And I'm not an expert on Professor Lowe. But you could see him at county fairs all throughout the North. And gaze in amazement at, Professor Lowe's balloon and all this. I kind of think about, Dorothy and, taking off, the balloon in the final scene. And he's recruited by the Union Army. Hey, go up in your balloon and see what you can see. And indeed, they were able to this is pretty good. Now, Hooker, the divisional commander, he was kind of reluctant, what can you get, see from that? But Sickles said, look at these sketches, look what we can see. It's the real deal.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Civil War reenactor Rick Barham. Thank you. listening to Nancy's Book Chef on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Well, I talked about the uniforms, but you have a section in your book where somebody's describing the underwear, the underclothes. So let's see how authentic you might be, you guys that dress up. So I believe this is on page 36 in your book.
Okay. The weather here is milder than at Camp Caldwell, but it's pretty cold, and the Chautauqua people would do well to find out whether their friends are supplied with flannel underclothes, for we need something better than the government shirts and drawers, which are not fit to be worn and which are not at all comfortable. They are made of cotton and wool, I mean dog hair, and are very harsh. The government socks are a very poor thing, and the shoes, however good for summer, are not at all suited for the deep mud we must pass through whenever we move. Every man ought to have a pair of stout calf boots reaching about to his knee. We have each a pair of thin blankets. One good wide blanket with a good nap is worth a dozen of them, and that is all we can very well carry.
This is Rick Barham, and he's reading from his book, The 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War, A History and Roster. So when you dress up, and I thought this was so typical, that the government issue is just deficient.
Yes.
You can't use that. And then the meals were also, you earlier quoted somebody about what the meals were like, and that seemed pretty depressing, to say the least. On page 40, you have a description of what the what their daily routine was like. And they say by then they're getting tired of the band playing their tunes. And you say dinner was at 12. You see that? And what did they have for dinner?
Are we at the top of page? I see what you're saying. The men are detailed for various duties such as bringing water and wood. Then comes dinner at 12 of beans, hominy, and meat. Then, if the day be pleasant, battalion drill and beating of retreat at sunset. Then supper, and at 8, tattoo and roll call.
Now, wait a second. Tattoo?
Okay.
What is that?
Tattoo, that's just another one of the formations that they would have. Okay. There's different calls from the bugle and everything, different times, and tattoo was one of them.
So when you have this description of a daily routine, you could use that in your reenacting.
Oh, absolutely.
Then. That you have dinner at 12, and then you have beans, hominy, and meat for dinner. And then go ahead and finish that section.
Okay. When roll call and prepare to go to bed, this is our daily round, never stopping. If one is taken sick or goes to the hospital or breathes his last and is borne by a few of his few to his final resting place, and the three volleys are fired over his grave. So the idea is that this guy dies, they just bury him, do the little thing, the business of the war goes on.
It doesn't interrupt the routine.
No.
If somebody dies.
Yeah.
Well, another issue that comes up, and this is back when we're right at where the two sides are in close proximity to each other, close enough that a slave could leave the South and go across into Northern Territory. And then what did they decide to do with the slave? Did they let him join the army? Did they send him back? What do they do?
This was particularly tough in Maryland when this brigade was occupying Maryland, which was a border state, a Union state, but they were still had slavery. And so Lincoln was wanting to recognize the fugitive slave laws. Well, the slaves were coming into the camp seeking refuge, and General Butler, who was a Union general, a Democrat, who had a brigade up in Baltimore, he had established this idea about contraband, that we would treat the slaves, since they're
property, even though human property,
we would take them, and just as if we had taken somebody's rifle from them, okay, and treat that, and we were not going to give it back, and we would treat them as contraband. Very logical. However, this was making a lot of the Maryland people angry. And so you had Lincoln, who was saying, got to give the slaves back because of the fugitive slave laws. You had this notion about contraband. And you also had radical Republicans in the Senate who were saying, we got to stomp out slavery. And if any slave comes in and any officer is going to give them back, we're going to cashier that officer. And then you had New England troops who were very sympathetic to, you know, abolitionists and slavery. So now you have these Massachusetts soldiers, these, you know, soldiers from New York and whatever, in a place where troops or where slaves are coming in. What do? You just, you know, make it as difficult as you can for the slave hunter to get them. And you could pretty much, any officer could probably point to anything he wanted to do, he could find justification for that. So it's, yes, very tough spot.
My guest is Rick Barham, and he's written the history of the 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War. And this is one problem that comes up. And another problem, and you were talking about the Maryland area, where you don't know exactly who has enemy sympathies, mm-hmm. whether they're on your side or not. And so they have oaths of loyalty. And that just, it seems like some people surely thought, can we really demand, can words change a person's politics?
Well, there's a wonderful quote in here from a Union man who lives there. And he tells them, he says, the only time that these people are acting loyal is when you're there. And they'll take the oath as many times as you want them to. And as soon as you leave, they go back to doing their secessionist and treasonous activities. And there was a fairly prominent family called the Poseys who were over on the coast. And they were actually arrested at one point and shipped off to Washington for a while for their treasonous activity. Well, finally, I'm not sure the exact what turned them. They took the oath or whatever, and they were allowed to return. And General Hooker even used their parlor and paid them for their services for using the parlor. And while the man, Mr. Posey, seemed to be particularly fine and loyal, the daughter and the wife took up the unseemly habit of signaling the other side of the Potomac to the Virginia side with a mirror looking glass during the day and a lantern at night.
So that oath of loyalty did not change. Would not change their politics. And you describe, again, you're quoting Charles Gould, when there's a wet, muddy winter that makes guys sick. And this we had heard, too, that more, and this Charles Gould mentioned this, more die from disease than from battle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you can just imagine, I mean, how do you ensure clean drinking water for the soldiers? There are just so many problems.
There are so many problems, especially since they're living off the land. They're bringing in food that's of dubious quality for the troops to eat, and then they're foraging off the land. Another man in the regiment at one point, he says, that I have drunk water here that I would not have washed my hands in at home. And so there's this element of the unsanitary conditions, and it just goes on and on. One thing interesting about the 72nd is that you have these companies that are drawn from different parts of the state. And as the companies brought together and then the men start dying in the winter quarters, it seems that the men from the western counties, where they had grown up in pretty healthy conditions, had lived on farms and were fishermen, they're dying at a faster rate than the men from New York City who had grown up in the slums and in the ghettos and this sort of thing.
And so strong immune system.
Exactly. that the camps are, this is a luxury compared to what they're used to. And so somehow their constitution is stronger, probably, you know, from building up an immune system. And they recognized that when it was going on. I thought that was wonderful.
So aside from the battles and deaths called from that, the men die and there are funerals. And you described, well, actually, in the words of Emerson, described a typical funeral. He wrote a letter home to his parents, and you have this on page 40 in your book, right?
Okay.
That this man named Emerson describes a typical funeral when he's writing home to his parents.
Mm-hmm. It is a sight worthy of note to witness the funeral of a soldier. The music forms the head of the column, followed by eight men with guns. The next is the coffin, with a guard of six men on each side, and behind follows the rest of the company without guns. The pall cloth consists of the stars and stripes spread over the coffin. After the company is formed, is the manner of music commences playing a dearth march, and in this manner proceeds to the grave. After the coffin is lowered in the grave, the escort marches to the grave and fires three rounds of blank cartridges, and then the grave is filled up, and the band strikes up a lively tune, and the company returns to camp.
This is Rick Barham, and he's reading from his book, A History of the 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War. And Rick is also a Civil War reenactor. And I'm wondering, the battle scenes must be fun, but have you ever reenacted a funeral? Because you have the descriptions of them.
Oh, have not reenacted a funeral.
That's not what the spectators come to see.
That's probably true. But we, in our reenactments, we do have a surgeon, and they can see a bullet extraction and that sort of thing.
But no amputations.
Correct. No amputations.
Because that's
a little severe.
And I want to jump ahead to our friend Dan Sickles, a very colorful figure who actually he is relieved of duty at some point. And later in the battle, though, he has to have his leg amputated, and they save his leg.
Right. Well, he asked for it to be saved. He said, don't discard it. I mean, this is a situation, if you can imagine, the surgeon has taken over somebody's house, and literally the table, they're just bringing people in one after the other, and literally they're tossing the limbs out the window, and there's many descriptions of piles of limbs outside of the window. Somebody, whether it's his staff or him, before this happens, hey, the leg of a major general's too valuable just to throw in the pile. So, yeah.
Oh my.
And then later in life, when he would have dates, it was, I can't remember the hospital, I think it was Walter Reed, it was on display for many years, and he would take his dates to visit his leg in the hospital.
Well, as I said, he was a colorful character, and so missing part of his leg did not stop him from seeing the ladies.
Correct.
He was a ladies' man. Well, there are sections in your book where you say, for example, about Christmas time, they get their summer shirts and cotton drawers.
Mm-hmm.
That feels pretty typical, I mean, what you hear about the military.
Again, the snafus regarding the supply situation is we're here in the dead of winter. They're receiving all this light clothing. It's like, oh, brother.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that even if somebody dies, no matter what, you go on with your routine.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these routines was drilling. And on page 43, you have a description of what that was like. There's an author is writing home, and he's wondering if the readers of this newspaper would like to know what it's like to have to drill.
Mm-hmm.
Because surely you must do this in your reenacting.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We do a lot of drilling.
So you have an account of what... Yeah. And what the drilling is like.
Let's see here. Well, this was the day was clear but rather cold through. The overcoats were not exactly indispensable and the wind pretty strong. The target was a full 300 yards, and though the sun shone fair upon it, the wind crossed our line of shot in such a manner to make it difficult to take aim. This is, let me just say something. This is very unusual that they would take target practice. This is a description of target practice. It was considered a waste of ammunition to take target practice. And in modern, we can't hardly imagine that they wouldn't
not
practice. Yes. Markers were established near the target and also men to pass the number of shots between the umpires and the markers. The umpires were Captain Doyle, Willard, and Chadwick. The markers were drawn up in line and the numbers written upon bits of paper were handed round in a cap. Each man drew one. When the number upon the ticket was called, step forth to shoot.
So they did rarely, on this rare occasion, have target practice. But when this routine for the farmers, you said by January, the routines of Army life had become ingrained into former farmers, shopkeepers, craftsmen, and coal box sleepers. While some complain, they came to view drill as part of Army life and accepted with a certain amount of stoic pride. We used to think 2 or 3 hours drill with knapsacks a pretty tough exercise. And this is the guy who's author is saying this. Now we considered it a mere bagatelle, not worth mention. If any of your readers have any curiosities to try that drill, then let them fasten a bushel of wheat on their shoulders, a half-gallon jug of water, and a day's provision at their side, and shoulder a crowbar of medium weight for a walk of about 3 hours duration.
Yes, exactly.
So your reenactors, do you put on heavy equipment and
We carry our rifles and backpacks and everything. So yeah, that's a good description.
So that's what he suggested. You want to see what it's like to drill.
Yeah, it's very interesting because there's a letter from another man who talks about when you're a new recruit, you're all full of the vitality, the excitement, and everything, and the drilling somehow just turns you into this mere machine, and how a bunch of untrained men would be way better than trained men. And I can hardly imagine that. You know, I think the first volley of fire from the enemy, you'd pretty much get discouraged if you weren't trained. So it's
from our point of view, it seems like, well, maybe a few hours less drilling and more target practice.
More target practice would be
helpful.
What was unique about that target practice business is that was leading up to, they actually had a competition. And so if we continued to read, you would see that once the firing was done, they measured how many shots from center and everything. And they
300
actually,
yards.
And they won a little medal that the officers had pooled their money to buy and everything. I would love to have that medal.
Well, also on that page, there was this disrespect for the Sabbath, but somebody says, and this is Owen Street saying, war knows no Sabbath. So it doesn't matter if somebody dies, you keep on with your routine. If it's Sunday, you keep on with your routine, and war keeps going.
Mm-hmm.
You see where you say on that, on page 43, war knows no Sabbath?
He heard that war knows no Sabbath, but now he was to learn what this means. It became necessary to open a practicable road to Liverpool Point, as nearly as all provisions and forage must reach them in that way. And the ordinary road had become so bad that an empty wagon could scarcely be drawn upon it. To meet this necessity, his company and two others were obliged to work the whole of one Sabbath in building a corduroy road. This was revolting to his feelings and those of the other boys. However, he says, he did his duty in overseeing and directing the men on that day. He had on a former occasion deplored the disadvantages of the Sabbath as passed in camp, contrasting it with a peaceful Sabbath at home. Now he assures us that a Sabbath in camp, with no such work to be done, and with one of Mr. Beecher's sermons in the Independent to read, is a privilege which he greatly enjoys.
This is Rick Barham reading from his book, The 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War. And in this history, he gives us information in the words of the actual participants of what this war was like. And some of them are appalled that they're surrounded by gambling, drinking, smoking, swearing, vile books. Now, when this colorful character, Dan Sickles, is mm-hmm. relieved of duty, he immediately starts campaigning to get reinstated.
Mm-hmm.
And he manages to do that. And how does he manage to get his become a general again?
Well, he was kind of operating on a provisional generalship. And so when his when his nomination came up, the Senate rejected him because he was a Democrat, and they remembered how strong a Democrat he was, and they were concerned that he would just take his whole 5,000 men and march them right over to the Confederacy. So initially he was denied his commission. So he goes back to Washington. The brigade goes on to fight in the Peninsula campaign. In the meantime, he's pulling in every political marker, every favor that he has. He's beaten down the doors in Washington. And finally, the president puts back forth a nomination, and he wins by one vote.
19-18.
In the Senate.
Barely.
Yes.
But he becomes a general.
Becomes a general. And, of course, when he returns back to the brigade, there's a big celebration, and everybody's tossing their hats in the air, and everybody's very, very happy. But as you might have read, the 72nd had signed a petition to get out of his brigade because, him being a political general, they were concerned that he wasn't very good and that they wouldn't get much fighting done. They'd be stuck in the backwaters of the war, and they tried to get out to no avail. But every indication is when he did come back, they were happy to have him.
Well, there are exciting parts in your book. There are funny parts in your book. There's sad parts. For example, we've been following Charles Gould, who was a farmer, and when he writes letters back to his sister. But then on page 45, there's a letter that has to be written to his sister when Charles Gould dies of typhoid fever.
Mm-hmm.
Would you read that?
Sure. Dear Madam, although an entire stranger, I trust you will pardon the liberty that I take of addressing you on this occasion. I would that the circumstances that call me at this time to an unwelcome task. Your brother Charles was taken sick about 2 weeks since, which proved fatal. He died on Sunday night last and was buried on Monday following the honors of war. His disease was typhoid fever. While the life of a soldier is not calculated to improve his morals, I can with pleasure say that the vices and immoralities of camp had no influence upon Charles, always maintaining his reciprocity of principles that were the basis of his actions.
So there's sad moments when you have to inform a family member of the death of a family member. There was one character that I really came to admire and love, and that was a Dutchman named Klaus Ryborg. And he was fluent in several languages. He had beautiful handwriting. He was deaf, and so people made fun of him for a while. But David Parker wanted him to be his tent mate. And when Klaus, they called him Carl, got wounded in battle, he actually, after he was wounded, he killed five of the enemy, five rebels in one day. And he was wounded, but instead of wanting himself to get treated, he said, no, treat these other people. And he let three or four others be cared for before they got around to him, and he ended up dying. And we are sad to hear about that. But that was a very touching story. There's so many touching stories and inspiring stories in your book that I think people, particularly if they enjoy the Civil War, or even if they don't, they might discover that they have an interest in this.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you, Rick. My guest has been Rick Barron. His book is The 72nd New York Infantry in the Civil War, A History and Roster. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynsbr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.